You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast. Today was the 3rd of May. And on the programme today, after the rain, we have the sun. But how long are we going to have that sunshine? When is the next rainstorm on its way? Well, we found out with CNN's climate expert and meteorologist Brandon Miller. We also did a deep dive into best practice from around the world when it comes to flood mitigation. We spoke to a guy who's a hydrologist. He's called Dr. Jan Koels. And then we also found out how artificial intelligence can help mitigate floods. Meanwhile, our other hot topic on the show was Ryan Reynolds. Not just because he's Ryan Reynolds, but because he's made an advert for Yas Island. And we wanted to find out how it was made, how the deal was done, and the secret of its success. So we spoke to the marketing man behind it. We spoke to the UAE-based stunt experts who helped make it happen. And we also spoke to a branding expert. Plus, with TikTok potentially facing a ban in the United States, we took a look at India, where the popular app was actually removed from circulation back in 2020. So what was the impact there? Meghna Bal, who's from the Delhi-based Tech Policy Institute, the ESA Centre, gave us her analysis. And Chris McCarty brought us up to date with everything we've got to look forward to from this weekend's sport. Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Lovely to have you with us this Friday morning. And, well, what a difference a day makes and what a difference a fortnight makes, because the authorities were clearly very much so prepped and ready for yesterday's storm. And I suppose despite an already sort of drenched ground, you've probably got a higher water table after the superstorm of 2 weeks ago. The floods were actually cleared from the roads very quickly indeed. Do get in touch if there's any more sort of standing water anywhere. But the impression that I've got from the city is, and I'm talking mostly about Dubai here, is that we managed it pretty well. And it just goes to show that with enough forewarning and a sort of true sense of the scale of the potential problem, it is possible to mitigate against flooding. It is possible to prepare yourselves. And that is good news because, to all intents and purposes, the experts say we are likely to see more of this intense weather. So what is best practice, global best practice, when it comes to flood management? Well, we got talking about this on The Agenda because that's the type of glamorous, sexy things we talk about on our spare time. And we were thinking, so, you know, what is the best way to manage flood water? You know, is there a way of holding it back? Are there techniques that you can use? And are there, you know, can we learn from other countries where they see an awful lot more water on a daily basis? Well, we found one of the world's foremost hydrology experts, and he very kindly agreed to come on the radio this morning. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Jan Koels. He's an expert in environmental management and climate change adaptation at the University of Antwerp in Belgium. He joins me now on the line. Good morning, Dr. Koels. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning.
Hello. Good to have you with us. Tell me now.
Yeah, well,
are there widely held best practices when it comes to flood mitigation? Is this something that other countries and other experts have considered many, many years ago and that we could learn from here in the UAE?
Yes. So they are indeed like good practices. So they have developed in like the weather countries. Let's say I'm from Belgium, like Netherlands also is considered like flood prone. And so we have developed like a lot of good practices and of course also other countries as well. But I've also worked in south of Europe, which is like much drier and a climate that is much closer to Dubai. I've worked in Egypt, I've worked in Jordan. So there are ways to work on flood management, on flood risk mitigation. I can go straight into them if you like.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, I imagine they can be split into practical measures, you know, that involve, yes, that involve building and construction potentially. And then there might be the other more sort of strategic methods. Mm-hmm. So which ones do you want to go for first, strategic or practical?
Well, people tend to start from strategic because that involves like the government and infrastructure. So I also go for that. So basically, first is like draining, get better drainage, and for a city that often relates to the sewer system. If the sewer system is able to catch that amount of rain that you see, like in south of France, for example, they have sewers that are like meters wide in diameter, right? That you can stand in as a human, even walk through without any trouble. So that's like the clearly gray infrastructure thing. And then it's a lot about infiltration. That's more like nature related, right? That you need to foresee like space in your city or just around to let it infiltrate. And that relates also like to nature and biodiversity management in a way. Yeah. So we've seen that in many countries, if you pave the city fully up, and dry countries, the soil also doesn't allow much infiltration often, then it's difficult. We also need to get like storage facility. Sometimes they do it on the roof, eh? Like also South of France, same example, they store water on the roof in containers and so, but also in parks and special infiltration areas. Sometimes it's even under basketball areas or something, and they have infiltration areas underneath or under playgrounds or of course nature areas in the city.
So is it realistically about making space for the floodwater? Even on the days it's not there, you need to have these facilities in place.
Well, yes, so that is the trouble, of course. You have it one day, you have normal weather, one day flood, one day drought, but flood facilities also tend to help for drought, right? Like and that is more like an issue in Dubai. But I've seen this also with like Jordan and like Egypt. So they want to capture that water that comes with the flood. So, and capturing flood water for later also is about storing and keeping it. So you need to have that. But Belgium, Netherlands is of course a crowded country, very densely populated. So what we think is like multifunctional. We arrange it multifunctional, that if you don't use the area, if it's not flooded, that you can still use it like as a playground, like as a park, like as a children's farm or whatever. So that's the idea. If you are like densely populated, have like multiple functions, that you can use it even if it's not flooded. And it works also for drought.
So here in the UAE, we saw that in the last sort of week or so, they literally built barriers to the water. They actually built sandbanks alongside the roads to keep the arterial roads open. Can floodwaters be held back? Or, you know, could they potentially, those were obviously sort of temporary measures, but can you hold water back or does it just always get through eventually?
Well, yes. So like extreme rainfall, that of course is like an extreme amount that comes from the sky. Yeah? So that is really, you cannot prevent really, but you can reduce the damage, right? You can reduce the hardship. If you keep it up at other places, if you start part of the water elsewhere, then it doesn't flood that massively. But if it is extreme, and that we see also here in Belgium, we had like 2 years ago and this year as well. If it's really extreme, you just need to have coping mechanisms. Eh? So it's a matter of preparedness beforehand that you reduce like as much as possible the impact. But when it's there, you also need like efficient emergency action. And that's what you said in the introduction. The government was more prepared like this week or the civil protection or citizens themselves. If you are better prepared, then you also know what to do and it's clear. And it's a lot about communication then, about having information, who does what, where do you get the sandbags, is there information on how it's evolving in the coming hours, do we need to open some sluices, don't know where, if that is the case, like in Dubai, but it's that sort of operational questions, like what do people need to do, do they need to look for higher ground, where can they get sandbags, that sort of practical things is the good practice if you have an emergency.
Yeah, you could see that it, you know, the country reacted very quickly. You know, we made this transition to from a country that doesn't really experience sort of big floods to one that has suddenly got rather used to it in just a 2-week period. So you could see that those mitigation techniques were being introduced. I mean, I suppose with climate change and rising sea levels, are you expecting more cities to need to know these types of techniques?
Well, that is for sure. And the general tendency is that you get like more floods, more droughts, and even in areas that don't experience it, like this year already in the broader, the wider area, there have been floods in Tanzania and Kenya and Burundi. There have been so many kills and damage. So it's occurring more. Yeah, and it's a lot about being prepared. Like Dubai is a wealthy city, so they can organize efficiently and people have the means to protect. But communication and behavior is still something that has to be learned. Like how to respond as an authority, how to respond as a company, how to respond as a citizen, what do I do? If I receive like an early warning, a meteor forecast, how do we inform your citizens, which material you get, like sandbags. And so that's all trainable. Eh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've all become completely obsessed with the weather forecast here. I'd lived here now for just over 9 years. For a good 8.5 years, I literally never even thought about the weather forecast because it's more or less the same every single day, just getting a bit hotter around summer. But now, you know, we're suddenly all forecasting experts, you know, watching the cloud movements as they come across the country, you know, reading the colours of those maps and going, oh, well, look, it looks intense. That means we're going to have X number of millimetres. So certainly the citizens here in the UAE are ready to become weather experts. Thank you very much indeed for your expertise. Dr. Jan Cools there. He works in environmental management and climate change adaptation at the University of Antwerp in Belgium, talking through the various different ways in which you can control floodwaters and prepare yourself for these sort of big weather events. Up next, you'll pardon the sort of flood puns, but we're going to do a deep dive into the way in which you can use artificial intelligence to give you more information on where floods are likely to hit. Very much looking forward to speaking to Professor Biswajit Pradhan. He is from the Centre for Advanced Modelling and Geospatial Information Systems at the University of Technology in Sydney. It sounds so high tech. Pretty much not sure what that means, but we will be finding out with Professor Pradhan in the next few minutes.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, I'm sure if you look out the window now, and I know that lots of people have been commenting about it on WhatsApp and on other social media, but the rain is definitely gone. We've got some lovely clouds. I think they'd be described as cumulonimbus. Are they maybe I shouldn't attempt cloud analogy without cloud technical terms without looking it up. Cumulonimbus? Something like that. Anyway, there are some clouds in the sky, which is an unusual sight for May in the UAE, but we do have that brilliant sunshine back. And I think I probably speak for most of the parents in the UAE by saying that we wish our children had gone to school today. But we do understand that the rain we saw fall yesterday was considerable. And thanks to the authorities, and I have to say they really, really stepped up yesterday, the roads really did remain mercifully clear. But then you did have the added benefit that most people were told to work from home, which was a very good technique. And I have seen on social media that some of the previously flooded neighbourhoods did experience incursions of water again. Quite a lot of people who had been flooded before, you know, they had their sandbanks up, but I know that there are some bits of the UAE that are just more prone to flooding. And I know that those people are struggling again. And, you know, with climate experts saying that we are likely to see more of these intense rainstorms, I think it is fair to say that the authorities will be currently looking to find solutions to keep the city moving and, of course, people's homes dry. So we thought we'd do our own sort of little research, maybe help out a little. So it was great to speak to hydrologist Dr. Jan Cools just a few minutes ago. We are now going to look at how artificial intelligence could be used to mitigate against flooding. So joining me now on the line from Australia is, because we like to go far afield for our experts, but joining me now is Professor Biswajit Pradhan, who is the founding director of the Centre for Advanced Modelling and Geospatial Information Systems at the University of Technology in Sydney. Professor Pradhan, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining me on the line. Now, I understand that you have done a study on how artificial intelligence can be used to mitigate against flooding. What did that study show you?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here today and thanks for inviting me. It's 4:20 p.m. actually in Sydney, and it's right now, it's been raining for the last 3 days.
Oh, wow.
As you're talking about the rain, so rain everywhere, is plenty of rain. Look, artificial intelligence is something that is nothing new actually. We have been using for the last 2 decades, and lately with the help of other sensing technologies and also the data coming from such as the remote sensing data and the IoT data that is actually coming into play. So there's so much of big data that is available today. So that helps us actually to analyze and to see the pattern of the flood. Well, it's sometimes we may not be able to 100% predict actually flood event, like in the case that what has happened actually in Dubai a couple of weeks ago. So, but otherwise, AI can be pretty much actually used to crunch the data and to, in the GIS platform to actually predict a flood event.
Where do you get the data from? Is this a sort of satellite situation?
That's right. So the data actually, we are talking about the remote sensing based data. So we have different types of sensing data, such as the radar remote sensing data and also the optical remote sensing data. So we have too many types of remote sensing or satellites that is available today for us actually to collect the data at different resolutions, different spatial and also radiometric resolution. So that these satellites are designed actually for different purposes, and mostly we focus on the radar because it has the ability to predict through the cloud, especially when the, when the plot scenario is developing. And besides that, also we have the drone-based images and also the low-cost IoT-based sensor and also the wireless sensing networks that is widely available today, and those data also can be used for predicting flood events.
Are those models effective? Have they been sort of proven in real-life situations, for example?
Well, it has been pretty, beneficial, and it has been proven pretty much in terms of more than 95% prediction accuracy, because we have the new generation of machine learning tools and models such as the deep learning artificial neural networks. So they are pretty much actually useful to implement advanced early warning systems, which could help alert residents and authorities about potential flooding events well in advance. And these systems can utilize various data sources such as the weather forecast, rainfall data, and water level sensors data actually to predict and monitor the flood risk areas. So I would say on an average, I think more than 90% of prediction accuracy can be achieved.
I mean, that's amazing, especially if you can, use that data and use those models to target specific areas that are most likely to be hit by flooding. Then, of course, the communities can prepare themselves accordingly, and you can get the pumps out, you can get the sandbanks out. How about the expense of installing in order to get the data, you need all of those different ways of measuring it in the first place. Is that an expensive technology to introduce into a country? Because I imagine we probably don't have it to the same extent here as people do in other more wet countries.
As I mentioned, actually, some of the satellite sensors are pretty free, actually. Like, for example, the NASA, some satellites like Landsat and also like NOAA and other set of satellites that actually they are pretty much free. And the new generation satellites like Sentinel-1 and 2, they're also free. So everyone can be able to download this data and can analyze them. But the question comes because the temporal resolution and the how frequently this data are available, that is a little bit question mark. So in this case, obviously, we are relying more on the drone-based data or maybe the very low cost IoT sensors data. And these data can be pretty much useful for the real-time monitoring. Like, for instance, like leveraging technology for real-time monitoring of weather patterns, rainfall intensity, and water levels for drainage systems, that could provide crucial information to authorities for timely decision-making. And indeed, remote sensing technologies and satellite imagery can also be used to monitor flood-prone areas and assess the extent of flooding. So, as you mentioned, I mean, these sensors are actually getting very cheap these days. And I think in a few dollars, couple of dollars, actually, one can be able to, purchase them. And you could obviously, you have to, you know, like use in like in a distributed network. It's not just one or two sensors. And the beauty of remote sensing or satellite data is that it gives you the wide aerial coverage at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose to a certain extent, I'm still thinking about the amount of water that's falling from the sky and whether you can forecast that. But of course, it's not just about what's coming down, it's about what's receiving it. I suppose it's the type of soil, the type of sand, whether or not there's trees in it, you know, or whether it's an urban environment. And I imagine that must play a huge part in the effect of a big rainstorm.
100%. I agree with you. And therefore, actually, the improved drainage infrastructure plays a very essential role, because it's not just about using a lot of hi-fi and all this technology and data modeling tools and all that forecasting and even. But at the same time, if in the ground conditions, if the drainage infrastructures are not resilient, they are not actually well equipped. So otherwise, you know, we would be having even like what has happened actually a couple of weeks ago in Dubai. Mm. So investing in the development and maintenance of robust drainage infrastructure. So I would highlight the term, the drainage infrastructure is essential for effective flood management. And obviously modernizing drainage systems with smart sensors and automated controls can enhance the efficiency and capacity to handle heavy rainfall events. So, for example, like, you know, when you are building a new city, when you are doing so much of construction, it is therefore very essential actually to address these issues. Like, you know, if a future flood is going to happen, so whether we have adequate drainage system actually to control that scenario or not. So this is very, very important. And apart from that, the floodplain mapping and urban planning plays also a very crucial role, because like, for example, we can use GIS, the geospatial information systems, with the help of remote sensing techniques and data. And authorities also can develop very detailed plot plan maps to identify the high-risk areas. So that is going to be useful for the urban decision-making planning. And also one has to have restricted development. For example, like in Australia, obviously, we have these methods are in place, these practices are in place. So in order actually before, any kind of development that happens in the flood-prone areas. So, and implementing the green infrastructure solutions and also can help mitigate these flood impacts as well.
I mean, it's such an interesting field and one that suddenly everyone in the UAE has become completely fascinated with after giving it no thought whatsoever for many, many years. So Professor Biswajit Pradhan, thank you so much for your time this morning. Professor Pradhan is founding director of the Centre of Advanced Modelling and Geospatial Information Systems. That's at the University of Technology in Sydney. Thank you so much for joining us from a rainy Sydney this afternoon. We appreciate your time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right, turning our attention now to a very positive healthcare story, because there's been a world first clinical trial and it's found that a vaccine patch, essentially a sort of pain-free sticking plaster covered with microneedles, could be a safe and effective and alternative way to protect both children and adults against measles. Now, the research that's come out of Gambia has found that not only does this plaster remove the need for needles, good news for anyone with a bit of a phobia, it's also easier to store and to transport, which makes it really suitable for vaccination programs, even in the most remote regions of the world. And of course, this comes amid rising concern that there's been a fall in popularity for those traditional MMR jabs. And that has led to a resurgence in measles, even in developed countries. And of course, measles can be deadly. So Just how significant could this development be? Well, to find out, producer Jennifer Crichton sat down with Ian Jones, who's a professor of virology at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom, and he explained a little bit more about the study.
Everybody, when they think about vaccines, imagines the needle in the arm. And to be honest, it's one of the things that many people don't like about vaccination. There's the pain itself. There's sometimes a bit of pain later. And generally, there's a feeling that you want to stay away from needles if you can. The difficulty is, though, how to deliver a vaccine if you don't inject it. You can't really take it by mouth because it would be destroyed by the stomach. So it has to be introduced some way. And over the years, a number of different methods have been tried. Patches on the skin and dissolving films under the tongue. Even a sort of blaster guns have been used to try and blast the vaccine in through the skin layer without using a needle. And of these, the micro patches have proven to be one of the most encouraging methods. So these are simply tiny little needles in a little plastic patch, which are impregnated with the vaccine and then stuck on the skin of the subject. You don't feel any pain at all. It's just like having a plaster on your skin. And the vaccine is slowly delivered into the skin layer where it finds immune cells and an immune response is raised. It's not the first time it's been used, but this information is the first time that it's been used in a clinical trial in a real situation, in this case, in a group of subjects in Africa. And the results look very good.
Now, on that basis, I mean, tell me a bit about this trial and who it's been used with as well, I guess.
Yes, it's a trial which includes both children and adults, which is important because, of course, generally speaking, we try and catch children early on, either by going to a clinic, which may not be possible in a rural situation, or by gathering children together at school. But again, you have to imagine that school doesn't start until 5 or 6, maybe even later in some countries. And so by that time, it's too late to vaccinate, except for certain diseases. So it's very important that the trial, it does include children as well as adults. And what you're looking for is tolerability. You're looking for the ability for the patch to stay on the person. They're not going to pull it off. But also that, of course, the most important thing, that they really do seroconvert, as it's called, that they really do mount an immune response that's going to protect them against disease if they encounter it. And in this case, the results were just as good from the patch technology as from this traditional needle technology.
Now, in this instance, it was being tested with measles. Why is it particularly useful at the moment for us to have an alternative method to vaccinate against measles? Because we've seen a bit of a resurgence, haven't we?
Yes. Well, one of the problems is particularly in the developed countries, is that there's a rather lack of enthusiasm for vaccination generally. And unfortunately, the early vaccines, the combined measles, mumps and rubella, is one of those where coverage is not as good as it could be. So it's very important that we're trying to tackle that underrepresentation, the lower than you would like vaccination rate, that you come up with methods that could be easier to apply and could be applied without anyone worrying about the jab in the arm. And this data shows that it really does work just as well. And I think we're likely to see it being rolled out on a wider scale and indeed for more types of vaccine.
Is the expectation that this could then be used for other diseases as well? That would we expect to see similar levels of effectiveness with other illnesses in terms of vaccinating through patch?
Almost certainly, yes. I mean, you can never be absolutely sure that the immune response is going to be exactly the same until the tests are done. But given that there's been quite a lot of development of the patch, so there have been several research papers, for example, ahead of this clinical trial. So it was well known that the patches do work in experimental situations. So it seems very likely that actually whichever vaccine you apply to it will result in a sufficient immune response to protect against that disease. So, for example, I would expect to see it being tried for influenza in the near future. And it may even be tried with the new malaria vaccines that are coming out now.
And I mean, I think everybody was familiar during the pandemic with the challenges that we had with rolling out vaccines, with cold storage chains and all of those sorts of things where those vaccines were perhaps quite temperamental. If something as simple as a patch was to prove effective for lots of different illnesses, how significant a development could that be in terms of global vaccination levels?
I think it's primarily going to be a bonus in less developed countries because of the reasons that you say, that storage of the vaccine and getting it to the people who require it is more of a challenge than it is in developed countries. In developed countries, to be quite honest, part of the difficulty is the population not bothering to turn up. When the vaccine is there in the clinic, they just don't go and take it. So I think the most beneficial responses will be in the developing world, but I think it will be used more widely than that. I mean, just on a small point, of course, it's not yet clear that every vaccine could be delivered in this way. It may be that some vaccines are not stable in the patch situation, but certainly more than the current measles, mumps, rubella are likely to be seen in the future. Certainly, it cannot do anything but help if the vaccine is delivered in a much more acceptable manner.
Ian Jones there. In fact, Professor Ian Jones, he's a professor of virology at the University of Reading, just explaining a little bit more about the study into that vaccine patch. And I'm really enjoying some of the responses that we are getting on that story. David, thank you very much for your message saying, nah, new patches for MMR protection is an utter snowflake attitude. Give them the jab and then take them for ice cream. And I have to say, that has actually worked in our family.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Although the kids are off school today, it was supposed to rain. I think it was meant to rain. Anyway, it's not raining, and it feels like everything has moved on. It feels like the time has passed. The storm has passed. It's beautiful out there, actually. It was stunning last night as well. All that rain cleared the dust from the air. But we are all still a little bit on tenterhooks. Like, if it can rain that much in May, and if you can have a superstorm 2 weeks ago, what is happening next with the weather here in the UAE? Can we relax yet and just, you know, get into the fact that it's going to be very hot for the next few months? Well, we wanted to find out. So we spoke to Brandon Miller, who is CNN's meteorologist. He's also their climate crisis beat leader. And he says that in his view, the worst has now hopefully passed.
Yeah, the UAE is maybe becoming a little more like Scotland or feeling a little bit like the Philippines, maybe. This one, of course, that you've just experienced, not near as heavy as what we saw a couple of weeks ago. This time only around 15 to 30 millimeters or so fell in a 12 to 24 hour period over at least, you know, some of the bigger cities in there in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And so, you know, I think this would have normally kind of gone through and passed and just been more of a novelty. But coming on the heels so quickly of such a massive sort of unprecedented rainfall event that you had a couple of weeks ago, there's a little bit more of heightened sensitivity. And, you know, obviously you're going to have impacts from a rain that heavy in an area that is not accustomed to it. And as we've talked about before, not built to withstand that type of rainfall. But we're getting a bit out of the rainfall season into May. You don't see as many of those systems move through. So this is not only heavier than what you would be accustomed to, but also a little bit out of season, getting more into the drier season now. But that is sort of yet to happen.
Okay, so out of season, what does that tell us about climate change? Is this extreme weather something that we can now expect every spring? Or is it as a more of a result of El Nino and other weather patterns as opposed to climate change? Now, Brandon says it is a bit of both, but we shouldn't panic about this becoming a regular occurrence quite yet.
The question is, is this a new normal? You know, not necessarily, other than we are more likely to see heavier downpours and maybe a few more of the weather weirdings, we sort of call them, where, you know, seasons get a little messed up. We're seeing more of that and expect to see even more of that in the future. with climate change, but also with some of these natural weather patterns. El Nino, we know, is associated with some rainier times there in the Middle East, and also the Indian Ocean Dipole, something in southwestern Asia as well as Australia. It's kind of a sister teleconnection, we call them, these big weather systems that sort of control the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month sort of interannual time scales of weather. And the Indian Ocean Dipole has a positive phase and a negative phase, a lot like El Nino and La Nina. And in the positive phase that we're in at this moment, these warmer ocean temperatures and Gulf temperatures bring rising air in the Horn of Africa and in the Arabian Peninsula. And then you get the opposite of that over in Australia and Indonesia, where we're more likely to see drought. So those are some of the reasons behind what we're seeing with the rainfall. But again, this is stuff we expect to see more of, even with the natural patterns just becoming more enhanced as the atmosphere, the oceans warm from climate change.
Brandon Minnell, the meteorologist and climate crisis beat leader for CNN. Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Right, Yas Island in Abu Dhabi certainly seems to know how to make a bit of a splash. Their latest media campaign certainly caught my attention and that of everyone else in the office. And it is really making waves.
I've been an actor, a producer, a Welsh football club owner, and I could go on. So I will. Now, the new chief island officer of Yas Island, Abu Dhabi. It's my mission to create the first ever Yas Island. So exciting.
Yeah, that is the voice of Hollywood superstar and, as he said, minor Welsh football club owner Ryan Reynolds. Now, he has indeed taken up that mantle of so-called chief island officer for the tourist destination, following in the footsteps of Kevin Hart and Jason Momoa. I'm sure you will remember their ads as well. And I have to say, it's a huge coup for the team at Yas because Ryan's really rarely associated with brands that he doesn't own a piece of. You won't find him as, you know, the face of a coffee pod, for example. Like, he's the face of Mint Mobile, but I think he owns Mint Mobile. He's the face of an aviation beverage, she said, picking her words carefully. But I understand that he probably owns most of that as well. So it was very interesting that the Yas Island team, that the Morale team, Morale is the group that owns Yas Island or that runs Yas Island, it's very interesting that they managed to get him on plan ultimately. And, you know, it got us thinking, how does a deal of this magnitude come about? And we were lucky enough to get hold of Badar Borji. Now, he is a senior VP of marketing across Morale. And he said that Reynolds was a dream booking for the team.
Ryan's been on our radar for a while. And as a destination, one of the key objectives for us is to make a global footprint, you know, to just make ourselves famous, to make sure the world knows of Yas Island, to know of our offering and, you know, everything that we've been developing over the years and everything that's yet to come. We've done a brand revamp a few years ago. We've used COVID as a great opportunity to look at our brand, what it's missing. And one of the things we focused on is, okay, as a brand, we have entertainment at the core and at the heart of everything that we do. And our brand needs to represent that. We're fun, we're young, we're dynamic, we're full of energy. And at some point, we're like, you know what? We need to get out of COVID and we need to make not just local impact, but regional impact and global impact as well. And we've developed a strategy accordingly, catering to our different source markets. Chief Island Officer started with Kevin Hart, was a great success. We were like, why not carry on? Got Jason Momoa last year, worked great. And Ryan Reynolds, since he's been on our radar, we're like, he's got a witty attitude. He's quirky. He reflects the energy of the destination. He's got an immense and a massive global outreach. And we felt that if at any point of time we wanted to top what we've started, then it has to be someone of Ryan Reynolds' caliber.
I mean, he really is a huge star. And it definitely feels like a real coup that you managed to get him now. And what a great time to get him. You know, he's got a movie out, his football team's doing well. you know, right down to the fact that his wife was pictured at the Super Bowl alongside Taylor Swift. As a couple, they also have this extraordinary profile. How do you persuade them to come on board? Because it's not like Ryan Reynolds needs the money.
He doesn't. I mean, Ryan Reynolds is a billionaire. It's not the money for him. And it's a long process and a two-way street, really. You know, shortlisting is a process. Gauging interest is a process on its own. And then agreeing on the details of the representation and what the deal entails is potentially months in the making. Many might think, you know, like you said, it's throwing money at any name and being able to onboard them, but that's actually far from true. Just as we have our checklists and our criterias, these big names, and especially Ryan Reynolds, considering the reputation he carries and the fact that he's one of, you know, he's one of the biggest investors out there, they are very protective of their own brands. Unless they truly believe in our brand, our offering, and our vision, a deal will be far from likely. He has hundreds of millions of fans globally, and he's very conscious on who he partners with and what the brand adds to him as well. And during these conversations, he looked at everything we've been doing, you know, not just recently, but over the last 3 to 5 years particularly. And I mean, we're very happy that someone of his caliber was excited to work with us.
Yeah.
If you even check some of, you know, Ryan's partnerships or, you know, any of his brand representation, especially on his social media, you'll find the likes of Mint Mobile, which he either, I think he owns or he has shares in, Wrexham. A lot of them are either brands he's invested in, but not many. I think just a few over the years are brands outside of anything that he doesn't have shares in.
Yeah. And then what is so fantastic about it is that you then conceive of this clever advert. Now, to what extent was he involved in the conceptualization of the flying in to Yas Island?
He was massively involved. The details of what goes into a 30-second or a 60-second ad is insane. But he was massively involved. Every word, every action, everything about the ad itself, he was... He's someone that's very exclusive of his own brand, carries a lot about every detail. He owns Maximum Effort, which is a production house and an advertising agency. So he gets involved in every single detail. And it's a give and take, really. You know, we come up with a concept, pitch it to him. He'd come back with different ideas.
And lots of people think it was done using a green screen. Is that the case or was he on site?
No, it wasn't done on green screen for sure. He was on Yas Island. And he was in Yas Marina circuit for sure.
That clears one thing up. And I mean, are we going to see more of him? Does this mean that Ryan Reynolds will be making regular appearances on Yas Island, or will there be more marketing material coming out?
There's definitely more marketing material coming out as soon as next week. So I'd say just you can look forward to seeing one of these pieces coming out early next week as well.
Now, I know that you have joined us for this interview while filming. Can I put those two pieces of information together? Are you currently filming another advert with Ryan Reynolds?
I am currently filming. It's not filming with Ryan, but I am currently filming another piece as well, yes.
Okay, that's very cool. And I mean, ultimately, some people might say that you have peaked too soon with Ryan Reynolds. Like, how can you go on from this? You know, who is a bigger star than him when it comes to representing Yas Island?
I've seen a lot of the comments myself as soon as the piece went out. And one of the comments stuck. Only when you thought they couldn't top, you know, whatever they did last year. And every single year, you know, we get the same question towards, you know, late Q2, early Q3 by our leadership teams as well. What's next? You know, how are we going to top this? And it's not just, you know, Kevin Hart to Jason Momoa or Jason Momoa to Ryan Reynolds, but a lot of the other pieces we've done as well, you know, be it Staying on Yas or Yas Yas Baby. Or I don't have an answer immediately, to be honest. And we didn't have an answer at this time last year because Jason Momoa is a great success in his own right. It's something that keeps us on our toes, but it's also a very interesting challenge to crack.
As an individual, you know, as senior VP for marketing, do you think, you know, in your career, as you look through your career, do you think you'll ever be able to work with the type of budget that you guys must be working with again? It must feel like an enormous privilege to have this sort of scope for your imagination, ultimately.
You know, one thing I'll say, I've worked with a lot of clients, and Yas Island was one of them, that had bigger budgets than we did. But it's not necessarily about the kind of budget you have. It's how big of an impact you can make. And I'm sure you've probably seen a lot of other celebrity campaigns coming out of the country. And trust me, I know the majority of them have been more expensive than ours. But to us, the question is always, how can I maximize the impact that I make? Yes, we've got a very good budget, but it's not just budget. The kind of trust that the leadership as well has in us plays a huge role, because not a lot of companies or brands have that appetite for risk, have that appetite to keep pushing boundaries and keep, you know, breaking through and making headlines year on year. And it's insane, the kind of pace, the kind of challenges that we have on hand. I don't think anyone expected that, you know, from a brand like Yas Island a few years ago.
Very interesting indeed there to hear from Badar about how that deal was brokered. That, of course, is Badar Burji, who is Senior VP of Marketing across the Miral Group. And coming up next, we are going to speak to some of the team who participated in the making of that advert. Two of the Dubai or UAE-based stunt people who were involved. We're also going to talk about what makes an advert a success. What is the secret sauce? All of that to come in the next few minutes, right here on The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Lovely to have you with us. And we are in the midst of discussing this new advert for Yas Island in Abu Dhabi.
I've been an actor, a producer, a Welsh football club owner, and I could go on. So I will. Now, the new chief island officer of Yas Island, Abu Dhabi. It's my mission to create the first ever Yas Island. So excited.
That is the voice there of Hollywood superstar Ryan Reynolds. Now, he has taken up that mantle of chief island officer for Yas Island, following in the footsteps of Kevin Hart and Jason Momoa. As you could hear, the advert sort of features him flying into Yas Marina Circuit via parachute, and then he lands among the racing cars, and then there's that sort of funny conceit that you can't really understand a single word he's saying because the cars are whizzing around him. Now, the stunt was designed and orchestrated by two UAE-based stunt coordinators. Now, one of them is Ruan Lukov. He's a key rigger. He's based in Dubai. And Noor Dawood, now she's a stunt woman and the first female drift car racer in the Middle East. No, I'm not quite sure what that is either, but it sounds very, very cool indeed. And she is based out of Yas Island, where she teaches fast driving, essentially. Now, earlier I caught up with both of them. Ruan started by telling me how long they had to plan the stunt.
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks prior to the shoot that we went on a Tech Record 2 location. Initially, it was going to be in a studio shoot, but then they changed everything at the last minute. Yeah, we looked at different locations all around Yas Circuit, and then they started throwing the curveballs at us.
So the shoot actually started at, I think, 6. So it was like just a couple of hours. We needed just to get things done.
Our responsibility was the parachute landing on the track. That's all that we were involved with. And the biggest, our biggest challenge with this whole thing was the track was busy that day till 5 o'clock. And then we only had an hour and a half to get our rig onto the track and set it up and be ready to shoot. On a stunt like this, you would have sometimes up to a week of preparation and setting up and testing. And then the rig will be in position for shoot day. We had one prep day to build the truss rig, to test some of it, because we had time constraints on that day as well. Yeah. And then on shoot day, we literally did our first test 3 hours before shoot. Then we had to break that rig down again and have it mobile enough on trolleys that we fabricated because
To get it onto the track.
So we wheeled it onto track, get the crane in position, and then lift and build everything again. So this, in my rigging career, was one of the most challenging things that I've ever done because of the time constraints.
We made it happen. As a team, we made it happen because not anybody can do that, honestly. We're all talented in our different ways. We do complete each other as a team, and we made it happen. We made sure that it will be done on time.
So what were the other challenges?
He had cars coming from behind, and the action when the parachute should land, it was too many things happening at the same time. But like I said, we made it work.
I mean, just think, you've got a parachute, you've got racing cars, it seemed like they were in front and behind of him, and then you've got a Hollywood movie star worth over $1 billion, and you're trying to make all of those things work at the same time. It it feels like it must have been extraordinary. How long were you filming with Ryan Reynolds in order to get that perfect shot?
He was on set for about an hour and a half.
And so beforehand, are you rehearsing with a stunt double?
Yes,
this one.
Yeah.
You were basically Ryan's stunt double.
For the testing. For the testing. Yeah. For our testing, I was Ryan, but of course not on set. Yeah. But yeah, it's great to be involved. And every year there's somebody new as well. Yes, you know. And last year I was involved with Jason Momoa. So I was driving the car in the Aston Martin, with him. So I made him fit in the car. He's a tall guy. And 2 years ago, I was with Shaquille O'Neal. So I made him fit in the Porsche that we have at Yas. Yeah, it's insane. So that's beautiful. Now it's my third year doing something, you know, with a Hollywood star. And I can't wait for the next, you know.
How many race cars were involved in the filming?
There was about 10 because they wanted to see like the background, even though they were driving not too fast. They just wanted to keep on letting car pass in the background as he was talking. So yeah, they wanted to see a bunch of cars behind. The drivers were from Yas, the circuit where I work as well. I'm an instructor. So yeah, it was very challenging, very fun.
And what was Ryan Reynolds like to work with?
We didn't have time to really speak to him.
I think he was just very tired and exhausted as well. This is what we heard from his manager.
Yeah, because he only arrived that morning as well. And went straight into shooting. So long flights. And
we were kind of trying to motivate that this is a safe rig, you know.
Yeah.
He was a little bit like, because maybe he was scared of heights, you know. But then he felt good with it and everything went great.
And how does it feel seeing this advert that you participated, or, you know, you were such a key component of it. How does it feel to see it out there? And in many ways, it's gone viral. Like, it's been a huge success.
It always feels good to see that what we've worked on turns out well, and especially, you know, what the client expects, that sort of thing. So it's smiling. That's all.
Yeah. A job well done. I approve. And tell me about some of the other projects and the stunts that you guys have worked on, because you're obviously, you know, well known in this country and in this region for your work.
So I'm originally from South Africa, and from there worked across the globe on various productions in Europe, India, Africa as well. I would say some of the biggest actors that I've worked with before is Tom Cruise and Sam Heughan from Outlander, Vin Diesel on Bloodshot. And it's always good fun. At the end of the day, we've got to work out and make sure that whatever the director wants to see, we can create as close as possible within the actor and then his stunt double's comfort levels. And we always get it done.
Stunt coordinator and key rigger Ruan Lukoff there, as well as Noor Dawood, who's a stuntwoman and the first female drift car racer in the Middle East. Absolutely fantastic to catch up with them and find out a little bit more from behind the scenes. Now, we want to discuss what impact a good advert and a good branding strategy, like the ones that are being implemented by Yas Island, can actually have on a destination. Just to give you a sense of how many views that advert has had just in the last sort of 3 days, they've notched up 2.57 million views on YouTube. We can't tell, unfortunately, on Instagram how well they've done, but certainly it does feel like it's managed to go viral. And joining me now to discuss how to make a good ad, what is the secret of the success, is Simon Killeen, who is head of growth at the branding agency Bond. Simon, thank you so much for joining us on the line. I'm interested to know whether, if you have a celebrity in your advert, whether that is just a guarantee of success and you pay the big name and boom, you're going viral.
Well, first of all, good morning, Georgia, and thank you so much for having me onto the show this morning. The question, does having a celebrity involved guarantee success? It certainly helps, but the answer isn't no. I think the guys morale were speaking earlier on about the amount of strategic rigor that goes into finding the right brand ambassador. You know, it's a lengthy process, and it's one that you've got to be really, really careful with. Using a brand ambassador, it's not a brand new marketing tool. It's something that's been done for years. But you really need to take extra effort in finding that person who shares the same values as your brand. Somebody who reaches out and already engages with your audiences, somebody who can grant you access to those audiences. If you don't find the right person, it's going to look like the wrong fit. And I think in the world that we live in now, you know, there's more brands, there's more products, there's more services than ever before in history, as far as we're aware of anyway. So it's really, really difficult to get cut through. And in order to do that, obviously a brand ambassador can really help. But if it's not the right person, then it's not going to get what you want. It's not going to resonate with the audiences what you want. And I think also what the secret to success is when you're trying to find the right brand ambassador is you're not trying to force somebody to be somebody that they're not. I think that's the beauty behind Ryan Reynolds being used for Yas Island this year. Ryan Reynolds, you know, I know you asked the question earlier on, you know, where do you go from here? And it's a brilliant question. He's arguably the most marketable brand ambassador in the world at the moment, between the brands like Aviation, the beverage, which you mentioned, like with what he's done with Wrexham, as well as multiple other brands that he works on. But, you know, he's in a position where now he gets to actually be himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty in terms of what the guys in Yas Island are getting out of it. People love Ryan Reynolds for who he is. He's not having to pretend to be somebody else. Therefore, it feels real. And therefore, I think that's what's hopefully going to go to deliver success in really generating that mass awareness, showing what Yas Island is all about, and convincing people, particularly foreign audiences, to take that leap in coming over to visit in the near future.
Yeah. Now, I asked Bada from Morale whether how much he got paid and of course Badart from Morale Group refused to tell me because that's what you would expect, so I didn't put it on the tape, but I did ask. I mean, is it presumed that if you hand over a massive chunk of change that's going to pay off? You know, does that generate the same returns? I suppose that's the give and take that the brand is hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, it comes back to my point about the amount of strategic rigor, you know, that goes into selecting these brand ambassadors. Is the investment worthwhile? And I think what's an interesting side note is I think the people who represent these celebrities, like your Ryan Reynolds, like your Jasons, like your Kevin Harts, you know, they're in a far greater position these days in terms of being able to negotiate the fees and the value, I suppose, that their clients can bring. One of the key reasons behind that is data being made available through things such as social media. You know, any of us now, Georgie, you can go onto your Instagram, your LinkedIn, your Twitter feed. You can go and you can see the impressions. You can go and see the audiences which you speak to. You can go and see the engagement, the reach as a whole. That science, that data behind it is something now that agents are able to put on the table as opposed to, I suppose, just shooting into the dark in terms of trying to guesstimate what the value might be. I think for Ryan Reynolds, you know, I think the guys, I'm sure, put a major investment into it. I think, though, that's a demonstration of the ambition of Yas Island. And I think that's an ambition that needs to be demonstrated. This is, you know, Yas Island, I think, in the short to medium term, wants to be seen as the entertainment and leisure destination of the Middle East. But then, obviously, if you look long term, why not look to make it an iconic leisure and entertainment destination of the world? And with that, if you're doing that, you need to not only, you know, convince local audiences about the amazing, I suppose, spectacles and experiences and innovations that you can experience there and the curated pieces that are there. But you need to bring in those foreign audiences as well. And there's still a big job to be done in the Middle East. We're certainly getting there, but there's still a big job to be able to attract the droves of people from the wider world to come over. So that investment makes sense. But at the same time, you will always find brand ambassadors who don't necessarily go for the money. Some of them will feel that brands, particularly NGOs, are close to their heart. My probably favorite ever brand ambassador in terms of a campaign was Zlatan Ibrahimovic when he worked with the World Food Programme, you know, naming some of the names of people struggling with starvation on his chest in tattoos and then releasing them in the PSG, Parc des Princes Stadium, after he scored a goal, taking a yellow card for it. But, you know, he would naturally do that for free because it's something that was close to him. But there's also going to be brands that I think sometimes brand ambassadors feel there's an opportunity for them to raise their own profile. There are always going to be brands that are bigger than people. And I think sometimes celebrities will notice this. If you think about, you know, famous kind of publications, even like the Rolling Stone, people tend not to want to necessarily get paid a fortune to be on that because it's an iconic thing to be seen on the front of the Rolling Stone. If you're being asked as an up-and-coming high-profile celebrity to be the face of Rolex for the next 4 years, you're going to do that. Yes, you're going to get paid for it, but you'd be willing to probably accept less because it's doing as much a job for you probably as it is for the brand in the short to medium term.
Oh, that's so interesting. Fascinating. And actually, it reminds me of a conversation I had with one of the editors of one of the Vogue magazines, where she told me that ultimately, if all of the cover stars on Vogue, they do it for no money at all. So all of these, you know, even if you see it, not a celebrity, but a model on the front, a model will do that for free because of the exposure is amazing for her. So I'm really interesting to get that perspective, almost like lifting, we're lifting the lid on the marketing and branding world there. So thank you so much for your time. Simon Killeen, Head of Growth at the branding agency Bond.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello there. Welcome back to the show. We're going to chat about a slightly sort of unusual topic now. And it all stems from the fact that moves are being made to ban TikTok in the United States. Just a few days ago, President Joe Biden signed a bill into law that requires the company that owns TikTok, which is called ByteDance, to sell its stake in the app within the next 9 months. If that doesn't happen, the company's got another 3 months grace period. And if it doesn't do what it's told, it'll then face a potential ban. Now, ByteDance is, you know, being quite bullish about this. They say they have no intention of selling the social media platform, and they are vowing to challenge that legislation in court. And I mean, the mind just slightly boggles at the idea that an app that's being used by nearly 150 million people and growing in the United States could be banned for what is essentially geopolitical disagreements. But there is a precursor to this story, because back in 2020, TikTok was banned in India, despite it being one of the country's most popular apps.
Harry Potter like karne wale millennial, Harry Styles wale Gen Z, climate change se bhaybit hai Gen Z, ozone wale the millennial, cargo pants wale is waqt apparently sabhi hai. But who gives these generations ke naams? Jano in today's Pop Culture Patrol with me, Sucharita.
Yeah, now that is Sucharita. She's a movie reviewer and she is host of the popular Pop Culture Patrol show. And she'd built an audience of more than 11,000 on TikTok before she and many other online stars in India were actually just left without a platform. And there is a lot to learn from what happened there. Joining me now is Magna Bal, who is head of research at the ECIA Centre. That is a Delhi-based tech policy institute. Lovely to have you with us on the line, Magna, as always. Tell me, what was the impact of TikTok in India? I understand it was really very popular when it was banned.
Yeah, it was extremely popular. It took off really quickly, like it has been in other jurisdictions. And I think the thrust, or at least the purported thrust of why it was doing so well, is that it put the creator at the center of its business model. And now you see, of course, a lot of companies taking away from that and introducing reels into their larger social media or streaming products.
I understand that it enables people, often in quite sort of rural areas of India, sort of a platform, access to a platform that was free and that they could use to communicate and make contacts ultimately with a much broader audience. There was that sense of it being a democratizing force.
Yeah, I don't know. I would question the veracity of that claim, you know, relative to other social media platforms. While anecdotally people might suggest it, perhaps it was more accessible in some senses. But if you don't have any empirical evidence about the uptake of, or let's say the rural uptake of social media platforms across different platforms, then it's hard to make a decisive judgment on whether TikTok really was extremely democratized, because we also have a lot of local social media companies like ShareChat, etc., that you know, are offered in Indian languages, and so I mean, it would be interesting to see their uptake relative to TikTok and really what that secret sauce was.
What was the reaction when the site was banned? Was there any upheaval, any protest? Were people cross about it?
It was very sudden. I think that a lot of people who were influencers on the platform were left worse off. I don't know if they've been able to make the switch to other social media platforms, but it just goes to show that while, I mean, it was understandable, it was not only TikTok, it was a host of basically Chinese applications that were blocked. It is understandable because it comes from a national security perspective. But at the same time, I think it's important for policymakers to consider, you know, when they take action on large platforms, they're affecting an entire ecosystem, and there is an entire sub-economy within these platforms. So right now, there's a lot of talk about Digital Competition Bill, which follows the European Digital Markets Act, which essentially is trying to disrupt the functioning of platforms in order to make those ecosystems more contestable. And part of the strategy, at least in the EU and what is being replicated in India, is to reduce the, I mean, basically add friction in the functioning and sort of kind of turn people away from these platforms. But, you know, there is a whole influencer economy, people who are completely dependent on these platforms for their livelihood. And so you leave them, and along with a lot of small businesses that are dependent on these platforms for advertisements, worse off. So I think whenever any kind of regulatory action is taken, particularly on something that is systemic and something that is so large that it affects such a large amount, number of people and such a large variety of people, I think that some care needs to be taken about the impact of such interventions. But of course, you know, when you're balancing it against considerations of national interest, I mean, it's a hard thing to balance, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to hear how it all sort of took place in India and whether or not the United States is likely to mirror that experience. Meghna Boyle, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Agenda this morning. Really interesting to get your perspective there. Meghna is head of research at the ISIA Centre, which is a Delhi-based tech policy institute. Lovely to have you join us on the show again.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Keeping us company for the next few minutes is going to be our editor or sports editor, Chris McCarty. He has sent through this report for us with all the latest headlines. And it sounds like there's quite a lot to look forward to this weekend in the world of sport.
Well, a very good morning to you, Georgia. Happy Friday. You find me currently on the 6th at the Montgomery. Beautiful day for a bit of golf. And I'm in the company of a Manchester United legend, Dwight York, as well. He was up late last night. Why? Well, he was watching another of his former clubs, Aston Villa, in Europa Conference League action. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's start with the match in the English Premier League. It was Chelsea taking on Tottenham. Tottenham on this woeful recent run, beaten in their last two. You can make that a hat-trick of defeats. Ange Postecoglou on the touchline, far from happy, was the Aussie. Another game where Tottenham just failed to really get into this match. Mauricio Pochettino completing the double over his former club. Chelsea 2, Tottenham 0. Nicholas Jackson, the much maligned Nicholas Jackson, with the second goal in that second half. So Chelsea back to winning ways. That 5-0 defeat to Arsenal, followed up with that late 2-2 draw at Aston Villa, but 3 points back on the board for Chelsea last night. Let's get to Europa League action. There's only one story. That is Bayer Leverkusen. 47 matches now unbeaten. The job that Xabi Alonso has done has been nothing short of miraculous. 2-0 on the night. Florian Wirtz, this beautiful young German footballer. He is a star in the making. This new German side is built around the Bayer Leverkusen number 10. He opened the scoring. It was a second from the midfielder, Robert Andrecht. A stunning second late on. Roma had their chances. Tammy Abraham missed a header late on, which would have given Roma extra hope heading back to the Bay Arena next week. But Bayer Leverkusen one foot into the Europa League final. The other tie, so Marseille and Atalanta share a 1-1 draw. To Europa Conference League action, the big story on the night, Aston Villa taking on the Greek side Olympiakos. Eyüp El Kabi with a hat-trick for the visitors. Aston Villa 2, Olympiakos 4. Of course, the Aston Villa boss, Unai Emery, a man who's won the Europa League on no fewer than four occasions. He is a man built for European football. He came a cropper last night, and Aston Villa have got it all to do if they are to overturn the deficit and reach the final of the Europa Conference League. The other tie, so Fiorentina Fiorentina defeat Club Brugge in Florence by 3-2. So Fiorentina in the box seat there, and you've got to say Olympiacos in the box seat in their tie against Aston Villa. It's another busy weekend of sport, Georgia. Looking forward to the Miami Grand Prix in the world of Formula One. As for the Premier League, well, all eyes tomorrow afternoon, lunchtime kickoff. It's Arsenal against Bournemouth. That's then followed later that evening by the other title rivals, Man City welcome Wolves to the Etihad Stadium. It's going to be a cracking weekend of sport. The Madrid Open as well, in tennis, coming to its conclusion as well. So yeah, if you've got any plans, and I know you do, Georgia, you're a busy lady, cancel them. Yeah, I know the hubby probably has tried to convince you many a time to cancel the weekend plans to watch a bit of sport. Do it this weekend. Arsenal, Bournemouth, Man City, Wolves, they're the two big ties in the English Premier League. The Miami Grand Prix will certainly get my interest, at least for a lap or two, and we all know what will happen there. Max Verstappen will win a fifth race in six. You can bet your life on that now. But that's it for me. Have a great weekend, Georgia. Looking forward to catching up with you once again Monday morning on The Agenda. Cheers for now.
Chris McCarty knows as well as I do that I will not be cancelling any plans for any sports matches. But you never know, my husband might be locking himself in the sitting room with a big telly to do a deep dive into that football. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.